Hello, and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, October 7th, 2022. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. Last month, Buckingham Palace broke the news that Queen Elizabeth II had passed away at Balmoral Castle in Scotland. The Queen was 96 and Canada's longest-serving monarch. Now, Canada has a new head of state, Queen Elizabeth's eldest son, King Charles III. This week on Rabble Radio, editor Nick Seabrook interviews royal historian, teacher, and author Carolyn Harris to talk about how a new sovereign leader might affect public opinion of the monarchy in Canada. Dr. Carolyn Harris is a historian, author, and royal commentator based in Toronto, Ontario. She is an instructor in history at the University of Toronto School of Continuing Studies. She is also a co-editor of English Consort's Power, Influence, Dynasty series, which will be published in Palgrave Macmillan in 2022. She is also the proofreading editor of the Royal Studies Journal. Here are Harris and Seabrook in conversation. Take a listen.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us this afternoon. To get started, we'll start with the Queen. And what were some important royal moments for Canada during the Queen's reign?
Well, Queen Elizabeth II was there for key moments in Canadian history. She visited Canada for the first time as Princess Elizabeth in 1951, representing her father, King George VI, and she last visited in 2010. So a very long relationship with Canada. She was there for the opening of the St. Lawrence Seaway with American President Dwight Eisenhower as part of a 45-day tour of Canada, the longest royal tour of Queen Elizabeth II's reign, where the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh visited all provinces and the territories as well. It was in many ways one of the last big whistle-stop tours of Canada, where members of the royal family were able to travel by train across the country. The Queen was there for the 100th anniversary of Confederation and Expo 67, where she famously rode the monorail in Montreal, 1976, the Montreal Olympics. The Queen opened the Olympics as Canada's head of state. Another key moment in Canadian history is the patriation of the Constitution in 1982, another key moment that in many ways was the culmination of that gradual process of Canada receiving more and more control, first over its foreign policy, and then the ability to amend its own constitution. So the Queen was there for many key moments in Canadian history, and she participated in many royal walkabouts in Canada. So many Canadians had very personal memories of meeting the Queen or members of her family in both big cities and small towns across Canada. She extended the scope of royal tours far beyond previous monarchs. In 1970, the Queen and Prince Philip and Prince Charles and Princess Anne visited Tuktoyaktuk and what is now Iqaluit, visiting communities on the Arctic Circle who'd never received a royal visit before. And there was a lot of interest in the Queen traveling to these remote regions and not only engaging with Indigenous peoples, but subtly making a statement about Canadian sovereignty over the Arctic during the Cold War by being there as Canada's head of state. So the Queen's role is a ceremonial one, but she has exercised subtle diplomatic influence through that role as head of the Commonwealth as well, and has been there for key moments in Canadian history.
And you mentioned the repatriation of the Canadian Constitution. And I wanted to ask you, at that time, why did Canada choose to continue to remain a constitutional monarchy when the Constitution was repatriated?
Well, the constitutional monarchy had become part of the fabric of Canadian history and politics and law. Treaties with Indigenous peoples were with the Crown, and the Constitution states that the rights for Indigenous peoples would, you know, follow the framework set by the Royal Proclamation of 1763. So there are relations between Crown and Indigenous peoples, and also there were many different political interests among the various provinces, and changing the system of government would have introduced a new complication as well. And this is something that Australia discovered in 1999 when they had a referendum about whether to end the monarchy in Australia. And it was thought at one point that the Republican side might come out ahead, but there was no agreement in Australia as to what would replace the Queen. Would there be an elected president, or would there just be an elected prime minister and then the House would choose a president? Would the Governor General step into that role as president, as we've seen in Barbados more recently? So when having discussions about the future of the monarchy, the discussion of what comes next emerged. And it was very clear that even though Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau famously pirouetted behind the Queen, that he did see the value of the monarchy in particular contexts. And the Constitution actually makes it very difficult for Canada to change that system of government, as all 10 provinces would have to agree on changes to the office of the Queen. And it's very difficult for all 10 provinces to agree on anything. We saw recently that all 10 provinces didn't agree on whether there should be a holiday on the day of the Queen's funeral, with the Maritime provinces shutting everything down, Quebec not shutting anything down, and Ontario remaining open, but wanting there to be moments of silence and moments of mourning. So we look at the different provinces had very different ideas of even how to commemorate Queen Elizabeth II's reign. We can see what a challenge it would be for them all to be on the same page about changes in government. And then, of course, with treaties between the Crown and Indigenous peoples, Indigenous leaders would very much have to be part of the discussion about whether there was any change in government, as there's historic links there. So it's very different from Barbados, for instance, where a two-thirds vote in the legislature was enough to change the system of government, that in Canada would be a very complicated process. And the process of patriating the Constitution was already quite complicated in 1982.
For the Queen herself, what were some qualities about her that made her a good constitutional monarch? Or conversely, was there anything about her temperament that wasn't conducive to being a good constitutional monarch?
Well, something that made the Queen a very good constitutional monarch was that she was a cautious modernizer. She was not in favor of change for the sake of change, but was open to cautious steps that would make the monarchy more accessible to the public. So televising the coronation in 1953, for example, or allowing documentary cameras in to film the royal year in 1969, or we see in the 21st century the use of social media to publicize royal events and philanthropy. And we also saw the amount of entertaining at Buckingham Palace and the palace at Holyrood House in Scotland increased during the Queen's reign. We see the garden party, which had been part of the royal calendar since Queen Victoria's reign, but these were opportunities to recognize people's as achievements. They could bring their families, and the Queen would be able to meet with people from all walks of life. State visits as well. There are many examples of what had once been a state dinner just for a visiting head of state, were instead later in the Queen's reign accompanied with lots of receptions for, say, expats from that particular country who were living in the United Kingdom, or if there were people whose ancestors had come from the country that was being honored at the state visit, they also could attend receptions. So we see this expansion of making the monarchy accessible. And she also took her role as a constitutional monarch very seriously. She remained above politics in terms of formal statements, though she did exercise some subtle diplomatic influence as head of the Commonwealth. Prime Minister Brian Mulroney has spoken about this, that it was clear that the Queen wanted more done in, you know, the fight to free Nelson Mandela and bringing an end to apartheid in South Africa. But the Queen was able to encourage her Commonwealth prime ministers to find a solution to this without without openly going against British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, who being very conservative was against sanctions. So the Queen found ways of exercising subtle diplomatic influence. And that was very significant during that transition from empire and dominions to Commonwealth of Equal Nations, that the Queen found ways of bringing together all these countries who had this shared history. They'd once been part of the British Empire and were now a Commonwealth of Equal Nations. And the Queen could serve in that role of convening Commonwealth heads of government meetings, introducing different prime ministers and presidents to one another. So there were opportunities for subtle diplomatic influence without overstepping the role of a constitutional monarch. So the Queen did very well in that role.
For her son, the now King Charles III, do you see a lot of his mother in him, or do you think he's going to be his own monarch, that he's getting ready to do things differently?
Well, King Charles III is coming to the throne at a very different stage in life. He's 73 and has been heir to the throne for 70 years. So for as long as he can remember, he has been the heir to the throne, Prince of Wales from 1958, invested in Caernarfon Castle in 1969, and has built a very public reputation as the Prince of Wales. In that role, he's been able to be more outspoken, whether it's his views on organic farming or on preserving traditional architecture. And some of these views were considered rather eccentric when it was the 1970s and he was wanting to introduce a recycling program, a bottle bank, as it was then called at Buckingham Palace. But now in the 21st century, his concern about climate change is seen as being very topical and very prescient. So the Queen was just 25 when she came to the throne and was in many ways just beginning her public life. And much of her adult life unfolded as queen, whereas the public feels they know the new King Charles III and his views quite well as he's been in the public eye as Prince of Wales. In his accession address, the new King Charles III indicated that he isn't going to have the same kind of time to devote to his various causes and passions, that he's now a constitutional monarch. And so that's going to lead to shifting priorities. So we see he's not going to be attending the climate conference in Egypt, where as Prince of Wales, he would have been attending, depending on his other responsibilities. So we're seeing that transition from being quite an outspoken Prince of Wales to being a constitutional monarch above politics unfolding. We also saw in the accession address that Charles III is very interested in progress and modernization, and we see the recent royal tours that he conducted as Prince of Wales. Yes, there were big royal set piece events like, you know, the musical ride with the RCMP in Ottawa, but there was also a lot of emphasis on topical issues, a conference on sustainable financing, meeting with Ukrainian Canadians to discuss their concerns over Russia's invasion of the Ukraine, meeting with Indigenous peoples in the Arctic about the effects of climate change there. So I think we're going to see with overseas tours and state visits, a lot of emphasis on current events and the environment and the issues that are very topical in the 21st century.
For how the monarchy is viewed, especially since the turn of the century, how do you feel the monarchy is viewed in Canada, especially with this major change?
Well, views of the monarchy are complicated. If we look at Queen Elizabeth II's reign, we see royal tours where there was a lot of popularity for the monarchy or visiting members of the royal family, and royal tours that were not particularly well received. And then we see predictions about royal tours as to whether they'd be well received, and that doesn't always play out in real life. Certainly the Queen's early tours as Princess Elizabeth in 1951 and then opening Parliament in 1957 and opening the St. Lawrence Seaway in 1959, we see enormous crowds coming out to see Queen Elizabeth II and Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh. And those who expressed anti-monarchist views were almost shouted down. There was a CBC journalist, Joy Davidson, who stated on an American program, which may have been part of the problem, that like many Canadians, she was indifferent to the monarchy. And now we wouldn't see that as surprising. There's a royal tour, there's debate about the future of the monarchy. But at the time, Toronto Mayor Nathan Phillips made a statement that she does not speak for the people of Toronto or for Canadians. And so she later walked back on some of her comments that it was just that distracting from the tour as a whole. And so it's interesting to see in 1959, having an anti-monarchist sentiment, even a gentle one about indifference, was seen as very controversial at that time. But just a few years later, in 1964, the Queen faced protesters when visiting Quebec City and Montreal. The Queen was fluently bilingual, and she spoke in French to the Quebec legislature and stated that she was happy that there was a Commonwealth realm where she could express herself in French. So the Queen's sentiments were very on point in terms of rising Quebec nationalism at that time, but her role as queen had gone from being seen as a guarantor of minority rights in a wider democracy to being seen as a symbol of British oppression. So there were certainly protests at that time. We see in the 1970s and 1980s almost a less focus on members of the royal family. The royal tours not attracting quite as much attention, with some exceptions, of course, that tour of the Arctic in 1970, the patriation of the Constitution, and certainly there remain communities and part of the country that were quite staunchly monarchists. But there begins to be concerns of, will the crowds be there, particularly after the various royal scandals that hit in the 1990s. And then we see in 2002, there had been concerns going into the Queen's Golden Jubilee year that there wouldn't be the same interest in the monarchy because of the death of Diana, Princess of Wales, the number of royal scandals that had rocked the monarchy in the 1990s. But instead, we see almost a parallel of 1959, only this time it was Deputy Prime Minister John Manley who questioned whether Canada should remain a monarchy. And it's interesting to see at the time that his comments were viewed as very ill-timed, that he was supposed to be escorting the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh on this tour, and there he was criticizing the monarchy. And so Jean Chrétien was having to say, well, that's a personal view. He doesn't represent the government. So it's interesting to see the parallels. Fascinatingly, in 2002, the polling data was supportive of the Queen, but many Canadians didn't quite understand the system of government, in that more than half of Canadians said the monarchy is part of Canadian culture and it helps make Canada distinct from the United States. But when asked who is our head of state, only 5% named the Queen. Some thought it was the Prime Minister or the Governor General. So the sense that the monarchy was something that was Canadian, in 2002, that was emphasized. The Queen dropped the puck at a Vancouver Canucks game and watched the game with Wayne Gretzky, and the royal monogram was up on the Jumbotron with everyone cheering. So there's a very strong emphasis on the Queen as part of Canadian culture, but the system of government, the constitutional monarchy, wasn't necessarily well understood. We see later in the 21st century, there have been periods where there's a lot of interest. The Queen's last visit in 2010, where she was celebrating Canada Day on Parliament Hill, the marriage of William and Catherine, the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, now the Prince and Princess of Wales, and their decision to tour Canada as their first overseas tour as a married couple, the Diamond Jubilee in 2012, the birth of Prince George in 2013. There was a very good run of positive royal coverage about 10 years ago. And now we see with the transition, there's a lot of popular sympathy for Charles III. Britain's coming out of a pandemic with the energy crisis as well, and the new king has just lost his mother and is stepping into this role. But there have been recent controversies in terms of particularly the activities of more junior members of the royal family. So a big difference that we see between Queen Elizabeth II and King Charles III is Queen Elizabeth II encouraged her aunts, uncles, cousins to take on royal duties, whereas Charles III is very focused on himself, his consort, and the new Prince and Princess of Wales, rather than a big royal extended family all undertaking public engagement. So certainly over the past 70 years, interest in the monarchy has waxed and waned. And there are many people who are not necessarily monarchists who have a lot of personal respect for Queen Elizabeth II, her decades of public service, who are more skeptical of King Charles III in that role. And so it remains to be seen how he will be received as king when inevitably there is a common Commonwealth tour. Queen Elizabeth II and Prince Philip went on a very long tour in 1953, 1954 around the world. And it's unlikely the tour will be quite as long for Charles III and Camilla, the Queen consort, but we will likely see them in Canada in the coming months and years in that role as King and Queen of Canada.
All right. And I'm glad that you touched a little bit on the complex history of the monarchy, because that brings me to the question. When Queen Elizabeth passed away earlier this year, you know, the Pope offered an apology to Indigenous Canadians for the role in residential schools. I saw some Indigenous commentators say that they're disappointed that they never got that apology from the Queen. The monarchy is an institution. Yeah. What are some of the things that they've tried to do to reconcile with the complex history they have with Canada?
Well, we've seen in recent decades the Queen and the Prince of Wales acknowledging this very difficult British imperial history, not just in Canada, but in the wider world. The Queen, when she visited Amritsar in India in 1997, had a moment of silence where there had been a massacre by British troops. And although no words were spoken, the moment of silence was very widely reported in the Indian press and was appreciated as an example of the Queen clearly being aware of this history. And one of the Queen's great diplomatic moments of the 21st century was her visit to the Republic of Ireland in 2011, where in a speech that included Gaelic, she stated that there were things that could have and should have been done differently. Once again, not an overt apology, but an acknowledgement of that very difficult history. We've seen her son, Prince Charles, now King Charles III, speaking more forcefully about some of these moments in the history of the British Empire and Commonwealth. So in Barbados last year, he commented that there had been this atrocity of slavery, and Prince William, now the Prince of Wales, also on his Caribbean tour, also spoke about slavery. And we saw the acknowledgement of the pain of residential school survivors by Prince Charles in 2022 on the Platinum Jubilee tour as well. So we've seen acknowledgement of these various moments, but certainly there have been calls for more forceful statements. Particularly Indigenous peoples have commented on the doctrine of discovery that underpins British colonialism, and that the Crown should more overtly revoke that and apologize for that. But one of the complications of being a constitutional monarch is the monarch acts on the advice of the Prime Minister. So any discussion regarding, say, reparation for slavery in the Caribbean, or a more personal acknowledgement of relations with Indigenous peoples as well, and a lot of that would have to unfold with government advice. There is only so much members of the royal family can do independently in that role of being above politics.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Carolyn Harris, for sharing these insights with our audience.
Thank you.
That was a conversation between royal historian and author Carolyn Harris and Rabble's editor Nick Seabrook. Thank you so much for that, Nick and Carolyn. Switching gears now to the news of the week, here's Nick again with our In Case You Missed It news wrap-up of Rabble.ca. Take it away, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week in Canadian politics, Carl Nirenberg dissects Quebec's recent election, which saw François Legault's governing Coalition Avenir Québec, also known as the CAQ, return to power with a massive majority of 90 seats out of 125. Legault was able to gain a large majority in the National Assembly, despite receiving only around 40% of the popular vote. Throughout his first term as premier and during this year's election campaign, Legault catered to divisive identity politics, most notably with his Law 21, which prohibits public servants who exercise authority from wearing visible religious signs. This law most directly affects Muslim women who choose to wear the hijab. This law was supported not only by Legault's CAQ, but also by the Populist Conservative Party of Quebec and the Parti Québécois. The law has been opposed by the Quebec Liberals and the left-wing Québec Solidaire. Less than 30% of the electorate voted for the two parties who opposed Law 21, Nirenberg writes. He adds, quote, "The other three parties who garnered about 70% of the vote all unconditionally supported Legault's flagrantly discriminatory measure, end quote. Also in Canadian politics, national politics reporter Stephen Wentzel reported on a class action suit filed by the Black Class Action Secretariat, which alleges that the federal government of Canada has discriminated against and excluded Black public service employees. The suit claims that it has more than 50 years of recorded inquiries, investigations, questionnaires, commissions, audits, and reports that, quote, have evidenced institutional and systemic barriers that resulted in the widespread practice of Black employee exclusion, end quote. The suit argues that the government remedies to anti-Black racism have not only failed to address the problem, but have instead perpetuated and exacerbated the systemic inequalities and racism faced by Black Canadians. The Black Class Action Secretariat has received support from the Public Service Alliance of Canada, Amnesty International Canada, as well as the federal NDP. NDP leader Jagmeet Singh told reporters last week, quote, not only does the federal government need to get to the table to respect Black public service workers who have faced and continue to face discrimination at work, they must take a leadership role in understanding how policies continue to impact Black communities and contribute to systemic racism, end quote. Also this week, Stephen Wentzel reported on an Amnesty International press conference which called out negligence and a lack of accountability from police investigating the disappearance and deaths of missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit peoples. Ahead of the National Day of Action for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, Girls, and Two-Spirit Peoples, relatives of women and girls who disappeared or died were invited to this press conference to voice their frustrations with the police. Natasha Harrison, a mother of one of the victims, noted that her daughter Tatiana would have celebrated her 21st birthday last week. Harrison said, "We need to end the careless disregard for human life based on race, stigma, and class. All humans deserve justice." Rabble is happy to announce that we have shared our next installment in our 2022 Rabble Rousers to Watch series. This month, we introduce you to Bianca Mugjieni, the director of the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute. Rabble community editor Mick Sweetman sat down with Mugjieni to talk about what inspires her work with Canada's diplomatic aid, intelligence, trade, and military policies abroad. Read Mugjieni's full interview on the site today. Finally, in recognition of National Islamic History Month in Canada, October's Off the Hill political panel will center around what cultural responses and political actions are needed to confront Islamophobia. Join our regular co-hosts Robin Brown and Libby Davies, as well as special guests Senator Salma Atawalajan, Rabble columnist Moni Mazig, and Rabble parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg on October 18th, 2022. Register for this free event on the site today. As always, you can find the full version of these stories and much, much more on rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Follow us on social media across channels at RabbleCA. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Finally, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.